Interview with Justin Klein, December 1st, 2010, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, by Kenneth Durr. All right, well, let's start with some background. It appears that you're a Philadelphia native, is that right?
Actually, I'm a New York native.
Oh, okay.
I'm a New York native, but I did go to undergraduate school at the University of Pennsylvania. Right. And I went to law school in Washington at GW. I was in private practice for probably just shy of 2 years, and I went to the SEC in February of 1974.
What did you do in the private practice?
I was at sort of a boutique litigation firm, which interestingly had a bunch of Watergate people who went to testify before the congressional committee that was investigating the Watergate.
So you were representing the Watergate people?
Well, yes. Yeah, our firm represented a couple of the Watergate people, and we actually represented one of the Agnew people. Agnew was also in hot water. And
right, right.
One of those folks. So, you know, I did a little bit of that, and I just wanted to get an expertise under my belt. I was not getting an expertise being in private practice. I was having a lot of fun, but I was not.
Had you been thinking about the securities industry or
I took securities regulation in law school, and I loved it.
Okay.
And so that was really the...
Who did you take it with? Do you remember?
Law school? Sure. Yeah. Harold Green.
Okay.
And Harold Green, I don't know whether Harold is still alive. His son is a guy that I met on a couple of deals. His name is Phil Green. Phil Green was in law school, I think, about 2 or 3 years behind me. And he actually was on the board of a public company that we represented a couple of years ago, and so I used to see Phil from time to time, and I would obviously inquire about Harold Green, who I thought was terrific.
Okay, so this interest in securities law had been percolating back there while you were in private practice.
Yeah, well, while I was in law school, and then when I was in private practice, I really did virtually no securities stuff. And when I decided to go out and go get an expertise, I was sort of immediately attracted to going to the SEC, and so I. And I was 2 years out of law school, so I was, you know, sort of prime property, you know, somebody who had a little bit of private practice training, and I talked to a bunch of government agencies and had a pile of offers, and I went to the SEC.
Okay. Now, did you interview at a particular particular part?
At the SEC?
Yeah.
I interviewed in investment management and in market reg, and I got offers at both, and I went to market reg.
Okay.
Which is, I guess... It's now trading in markets again.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Things keep going around. Everything
comes around.
Who did you interview with at Market Reg? How did that work?
Actually, I went to work for a guy named Dan Polero, who died a number of years ago. And his boss was Lee Picard, who I assume is very much around and alive. I see Lee. I haven't seen him in years, but, you know, I see Lee from time to time.
Yeah, he sure is.
And Lee must be 70 years old by now. Maybe more than that, but he's a great guy. Lee was a terrific guy.
So what did you get into when you came in?
I was in a broker-dealer compliance program.
Okay.
We actually were responsible for making sure that the exchanges and then the NASD had adequate programs in place to survey their members, and one of the things that we did a lot of work on was the CBOE, which was, you know, kind of a brand new thing in the early 70s.
Right.
And I think the first trip I ever took was to Chicago to the CBOE, and I think I probably went with Herb Brooks, who's still at the SEC in trading and markets.
Huh.
So I had a very old and dear friend. So.
Tell me a little bit about going to the CBOE and seeing this new kind of animal. Granted, you hadn't been in the SEC for that long, but tell me a little bit about that emerging business.
I guess one of the reasons that it was so interesting was I think that there were only trading options on 10 stocks at the time, and I think that each time they wanted to add stocks, they had to come to the commission to ask the commission's permission. And so one of the things that we were... responsible for doing was making sure that they could adequately surveil their members who were trading these options. And one of the things we were terribly concerned about was the suitability of options for a retail investor. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to make sure that there were adequate programs in place for brokers who were trying to sell these options to people, that they made the people understand what the risks in trading these options were.
Had they set up structures to do that?
I think so, but I think we were probably helping them along. And I think that at each juncture, and I can't remember what the numbers were, but each time they sort of came in to add stocks on which they would trade options, we would do some analysis as to whether or not they had adequate facilities to surveil the trading of them, and then adequate facilities to make sure that the brokers that were selling them were doing so in a responsible way. And I can't remember whether there might have been some odd capital requirements associated with options trading. I can't remember that all that well. But I do have, a reasonably vivid recollection of being, I don't know, it was the cutting edge of anything, but, it was certainly the nascent part of the trading in stock options. And then I can't remember when they went into puts, but I think that there was a CBOE, and then the Amex got into it, so we went to inspect the Amex, and then the Pacific got into it, and I don't really remember the sequence after that.
Things were moving pretty fast at that point. The CBOE in particular was supposedly a pilot project.
It was a pilot project they spun off from the Chicago Board of Trade, as I recall.
But I mean, even for the SEC, I think the idea was...
Yes, it was viewed as a pilot. It was absolutely viewed as a pilot. And they kept coming in and saying, we want to trade more. And we sort of kept saying, hold on, you're a pilot. So.
Okay. Do you remember when that went away, when the decision was made that they weren't a pilot anymore? Or was that after the moratorium?
I don't remember that.
So. Okay.
Yeah, then there was that options study that they did. I guess Harold Williams had become the chair, so that was in 76 or 7. He was Carter's chair. And I think Harold Williams was the guy who got that options study done, and T-Berg was the guy who led that. I think he died a number of years ago, Dick T-Berg.
Yeah. I guess I just want to get a sense from you as to whether your folks, the people you were working with, were particularly concerned. I mean, it was a pretty big deal to at some point say, just kind of freeze the market. The SEC was deeply concerned at that point, and I'm wondering if the concerns went back to when you were dealing with the options market.
There was a deep concern about this stuff. There was a deep concern about them expanding and expanding too quickly. And there was also sort of the view, I think it probably came out of the Division of Enforcement, is was this really gambling? Were we really legalizing gambling by allowing them to move forward? And I think that there were probably divisions in the Division of then Market Regulation as to whether to go. I think that there were probably sort of the more conservative types who said, this is going too quickly. And then I think that Lee was probably in favor of just, kind of getting this going and let competitive forces take their... But I don't want to put any words in Lee's mouth, but I think that Lee was a little more advanced.
But this was a subject of discussion.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Within
the division and then amongst the divisions. So.
Okay. Did you ever take options-related issues to the commission?
Yeah.
Were you able to sit in on those?
I sat at the commission table on a number of options related issues. So,
Was there the same sort of division there that you talked about within and among the divisions?
Yeah, I think so, but I'm not sure that I remember that graphically.
Okay.
It was, God, I don't know, 35 years ago,
right.
36 years ago now, back when I had hair,
the big thing happening, of course, when you came in was that they're looking at the national market system or centralizing the markets, that sort of driving everything for market reg. How did that affect what other things that you were doing aside from the options work?
Actually, it didn't really. There was always this quiet drumbeat about what is now FINRA, and it's sort of getting a sole self-regulator. But there was never. But there were so many self-regulators out there at the time that there was never any real, real serious effort to get that done. But I think the central market stuff was really sort of on the market structure side. Mm-hmm. Those were the really sort of the smart guys, the real intellectual guys, and then there were, you know, kind of the meat and potatoes people like us. We were just worried about compliance and making sure that securities laws were being enforced and stuff. Okay. We weren't thinking great thoughts. We were just trying to get it right.
Some of that would have affected broker-dealer issues, though, as far as maybe making standardizing or simplifying.
Not sure that I can.
Yeah. Okay. Any other?
Hold on a second. I guess the only other piece that related to the broker dealers, which was sort of central market or national market related, was the broker dealers were always concerned about the fact that all of these self-regulators were coming in and examining them, and so what they wanted was they wanted a designated examining authority. And so if you were a member of the New York Stock Exchange, New York Stock Exchange were your designated examining authority. If you were a member of the Midwest Stock Exchange but not a member of the New York Stock Exchange, the Midwest was your designated examining authority. But if you were a member of the Midwest and the New York, then the New York was your, you know, so that, I think that sort of played around there. And there was always that, you know, kind of tension between the brokerage community and the self-regulators that too many people were piling on, and
right.
There was, as I recall, always sort of a, get your act together, don't send in the, so that the New York Stock Exchange would examine you for capital and stuff, but then the CBOE would examine you for options, and so you wanted to make sure that people kind of came in at the same time, and there was always sort of that complaint about, I just got finished with the New York Stock Exchange. We're here for 3 weeks, and now you guys are showing up. So
right. And was there anything that you tried to do about that? Was there any policy change during this period?
I think that we came up with the concept of the designated examining authority. I can't remember whether that preceded me or whether I just knew about that.
Okay.
And I guess you always sort of try to get organized so that they showed up at the same time or showed up at relatively the same time.
Right. Other activities while you were in Market Reg? Was most of your time dealing with the options exchanges and broker-dealers?
Yeah, all of the time I was in Market Reg I did that.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the only other thing, and it sounds like Let's touch this one. You made that neat distinction between the guys in the trenches and the big thinkers. Who were the big thinkers when you were there, and did you interface with those folks?
Oh, sure. I was sort of friends. I think Bob Lewis was one of those big thinkers, and Bart Friedman, and Merritt Cole, who actually practices over at White & Williams here in town. They were all doing that market structure thing and thinking great thoughts, as I said. And Bart Friedman, by the way, is somebody that I, you know, sort of episodically in touch with. He's at K.O. Gordon in New York, and I did a deal there about a year and a half ago, and I called him up. We spent, 15 or 20 minutes talking and stuff.
Would they get information from folks like you who were going and, you know, hanging around at the exchanges? Did they come in and say, you know, I want to know about what's going on in the...
Probably not. Okay. They were probably just thinking great thoughts.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the Office of Consumer Affairs. It was pretty new when you got there.
Yeah, it actually started, I'm not sure I have this right, but maybe I do. The Congress wanted to pass a law for there to be a consumer agency, similar to what you just got in this Dodd-Frank bill. And I think the Ford administration was opposed to that, and they told everybody to go set up their own consumer affairs offices. So the commission did that, and they set up an office, and they had an acting director, a guy named Van Carter, and Van did it for, I don't know, whether he did it for a year or a couple of months, I can't remember.
Must have been, something.
And then I think it was in February 1977, they had these hearings about... getting the arbitration systems that each of the SROs had in place, getting them sort of a uniform set of rules. And so...
This is congressional?
No, this was SRO rules.
Okay.
Self-regulatory
the hearings.
The hearings were SEC hearings.
Okay, gotcha.
On these rules.
Gotcha.
And so... they wanted a permanent director, and so they interviewed a bunch of people. And I can't remember whether somebody asked me to do it or whether somebody asked me to put my hat in the ring or whether I sort of voluntarily did that. I'd run a consumer center in law school, and so it was sort of a natural, you know, it had a good ring for me. And at the time, I was sort of angling to leave Market Reg. This turned out to be fine. And so out of those hearings came the SRO's commitment to go do this themselves so that the SEC wouldn't impose this upon them. And out of that came the Securities Industry Conference on Arbitration. I don't know whether you're familiar with that. It's called SICA.
Mm-hmm.
It's been around forever.
Right.
And so I was sort of the staff contact to SICA. And actually, I served on SICA for a number of years after I left the commission. And you know, SICA developed these uniform set of rules, which was known as the Uniform Arbitration Code, and we got those all through the commission, and I think I spruced up the complaint handling system at the SEC, and then in 79 I went off to be the first SEC person to go on the President's Executive Exchange Program, which was
right.
Fabulous.
Right.
It's too bad it no longer exists.
I want to get to that.
Go ahead.
But I want to get a little bit more on the Office of Consumer Affairs.
Which is now called the Office of Investor Education or something?
It's been folded into something else.
Oh, really?
Something. It sounds like it was sort of a back hip pocket kind of thing when you got there, was being... How much personnel? How much did they have in the way of resources?
I had about seven or eight people who were answering complaints.
Okay,
they were sort of GS, not high GSs, and it was they were part of something else at the time. I can't remember what they were part of. The Office of Information Reports and Information. They were something else, and I carved them out and took them out and. There was a terrific guy who was a branch chief named Frank Donaghy Jr. Frank Donaghy Sr. was the comptroller of the SEC at the time. And Frank Donaghy Jr., I gathered, retired a couple of years ago from investment management, but he was a really good guy. And he had this, you know, kind of ragtag group of six or seven people who answered complaints. They could barely speak English. And I don't want to say that. I mean, you know, they were just not... you know, they didn't have a lot of background and stuff. They basically took you get a complaint in from an investor saying my account at Merrill Lynch is all screwed up, and they would write a letter to Merrill Lynch and say, "We got this letter. Send me a report." You know, basically, it was really sort of a just a processing function.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't remember what we did. You know, we coded up the complaints so that we had consistent, so that you got X number of complaints about Merrill Lynch about this or that, and we established sort of a coding system so we knew what the complaints were and so we could see trends and so forth, which was not all that brilliant, but I don't think it was being done at the time.
What did you do with the trends? It seems
well,
like
we used to, you know, we call up Stanley Sporkin in enforcement and say, you know, we got this sort of trend. We identified this thing. It was very, you know, kind of cool at the time. Was firms used to engage in this practice called remote checking, where if you had an account in New York and you sold a couple of shares of stock and you wanted a check, they would send you a check from San Francisco. So you'd put the check in your checking account and it'd take X number of zillions of days to clear because it'd been written on a bank in San Francisco. And if you were in San Francisco, they'd send you one from New York.
Oh.
And so I remember we did this release, which was very controversial. I remember Roberta Carmel got really pissed off about it. So we didn't have enough complaints about remote checking or something. But in any event, so we did that, and there were probably a couple of other, you know, sort of not rulemaking releases, but sort of releases that got put out saying consumers should watch out for this and watch out for that and so forth.
And you were sort of putting the industry on notice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I think I got quoted in the New York Times. I probably still have the article. And I remember Roberta was quoted as saying something like, she didn't really think it was a problem. And then I was quoted as saying, we contacted Justin Klein, who clearly didn't want to get into a fight with one of his bosses. So, but I think that there's a New York Times article on that. As I said, I think I probably have it somewhere. So being in consumer affairs was fun. I mean, I was, you know, I was 29 years old, so I was a pretty young guy, and I was the head of an office.
And it's essentially complaints.
It was complaints and arbitration.
And arbitration.
It was complaints and getting these arbitration rules made uniform.
Something that did make it into the newspapers is the National System for Resolving Disputes.
Yeah, I'm sure that did.
Tell me a little bit about
that. Well, that's the Uniform Code of Arbitration.
Okay. All right. The reason I made it in was there was some sense that there was some industry pushback where people didn't want yet another body or somebody else checking in with them. And this had to do, I think, with small claims.
Well, no, here's the issue.
Yeah.
The issue was that the SEC was going to adopt these rules. We were going to just stick it to the industry.
Okay.
And then the industry came in and said, hold on a second, we'll take care of this. Okay, and so that's when CICA got formed, and that's when they did their own rules.
Okay.
And so those became SRO rules as opposed to... I guess I'm glad you had to think about small claims. There was some... Rod Hills was quoted as saying he wanted there to be... a system in place so that an investor could resolve a dispute about a postage stamp. And that might even be a quote. That might even be sort of a good quote. One of the things that they wanted out of the Uniform Code of Arbitration was a small claims procedure whereby you could resolve something with one arbitrator on the papers so that you didn't have to have a full-blown hearing. And there was a concern about how much that could be, and I can't remember what it was, you know, some small amount. It was, you know, $5,000 or $2,500 or something that you could resolve on the papers. And that was at the investor's insistence. In other words, the investor could say, I want a full-blown hearing, or the investor could say, I'll try your small claims procedure.
Right.
So,
and how did the industry respond to that?
Well, I think once we got going. In other words, once CICA got set up and got going, I think the industry was probably fine.
Okay. So. Right. But there was a period there where you were looking at doing this without sort of devising something within the SEC. And
well, the U is interesting. When I came, I arrived on the scene at the time that the industry said, we'll do this.
Okay.
So right. Van Carter was the one who was sticking it to the industry.
Gotcha.
So have you interviewed him? Is he still alive?
I don't think I've even heard the name.
Oh, really?
Before. Yeah, yeah.
Van Carter.
But yeah, that explains, because I think it appeared to me through some of the records that you sort of got stuck holding this ball and you're standing in the middle of all of this trying to figure out what to do with it. And so the question was, how did it resolve itself?
Well, it resolved itself by the industry picking up the ball. I used to go to the CICA meetings, and I think that they still have CICA meetings. I'm not really sure. I think, I don't know.
Okay. Anything else we should touch on in the Office of Consumer
Affairs? The only other issue, which was a hot issue and continues to be a hot issue, by the way, is mandatory arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I can't remember the sequence of this, but I can't remember whether... whether we did any releases about that or whether... whether, I mean, that was, the industry felt very strongly about having mandatory arbitration, pre-dispute arbitration agreements, and there had been a pile of Supreme Court cases about that.
Had there been at that point?
No. There was one case at the time.
What was the SEC's position?
Well, I think the SEC's... You know, I don't know. I can't remember. I mean, I can tell you that there are probably... There's probably a release or two out there which says people should be aware of mandatory pre-dispute arbitration agreements. And I know that when I was on CICA, we redid some of those agreements to make the disclosure better for investors that in fact you were entering into a pre-dispute arbitration agreement.
Okay.
So. But I might have that a little screwed up. I don't.
Okay. But it was clearly a focus. Of
some
sort.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's go to the Presidential Exchange Program. How did you get to be the guinea pig?
There was a guy named Ben Milk who was the executive director of the SEC at the time, and he was really a pretty good friend of mine, and I reported to him.
Okay.
And I think he came to me and said, look, you know, we have an opportunity to send... Yeah, he was a big management guy. You know, he was always sending people away to management programs and stuff. And I think he came to me and said, we have this opportunity to send somebody on this. Would you like to do it? And it involved interviewing and having a bunch of interviews and then getting selected if you got selected. And then once you got selected for it, you then had to go out and get a job. And they gave you sort of all... The exchange program sent your resume out to all of the companies that had sort of participated in the program. I actually had two job offers. I had one at General Motors where they wanted me to do stuff about arbitration agreements in their, there was some, either an arbitration agreement or, you know, organizing their customer complaint. I don't know, there was something that tagged on what I've been doing. Mm-hmm. And then I had an offer at GE, and GE was really interesting because I can't remember whether they told me what I was going to be doing before I got there when I was interviewing, or whether they just hired me and said, we're going to find something for you to do. You know, we like participating in the program, we like having people, and you seem like you're a nice guy. So I can't remember whether that was it, or because what I ended up doing had nothing to do with anything that I had done anywhere. It was really doing sort of these public issues. It was the last, Reginald Jones, who was the chairman of the board of GE, was in his last couple of years, and he was doing all of these sort of business-related issues. I'll give you an example in a minute. And he had what he called his kitchen cabinet. There were five or six of these people who used to write these little papers about these public issues, and then he'd go talk about them with the business roundtable and these other fancy places. And he was very close to President Carter. Actually, he used to go to the White House all the time. And so I was with these people who were basically briefing Jones. It was great. And so the best thing I ever did when I was there was in 1980. I was there from 79 to 80. In 1980, Chrysler was going to go bankrupt, and the Business Roundtable was asked to take a position on the bankruptcy. And so I worked with these two or three other people at GE to come up with a Business Roundtable position, which was to oppose the bankruptcy, to oppose the bailout. Oppose the bailout in favor of the bank. You know, tell them to do whatever the hell they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so... you know, I ended up writing this, along with these other people I can't claim authorship credit for. It was a paragraph that long basically saying, you know, there are winners and losers in this world, and losers should be allowed to be losers.
It's a familiar argument.
And so the amazing thing about it was, and so we did that, and obviously that didn't carry the day, and the government bailed out Chrysler, and they bailed them out again. But my wife and I took a vacation in 1985 in March in Puerto Rico, and I bought Lee Iacocca's book called Iacocca, and I was sitting there on the beach reading this book, and there is the damn statement from the Business Roundtable right in the middle of the book. I said, "Boy, this looks familiar." So,
that's pretty good.
So it was those kinds of issues that I worked on. I mean, you know, some for Reg Jones, it was some for Jack Welch actually, who was then one of three vice chairmen at GE, battling for the top spot. Obviously, he succeeded, and there was a guy named John Burlingame and a guy named Ed Hood, each of whom went off to do different things. And Burlingame went to General Telephone. I don't know. They went different places.
So this is you get to be the big thinker now when you were.
Yeah, I was a big thinker. I was a big thinker. So, and it was a great program. It was one of those. There were about 50 people on it, and they were presumably high potential people, both in government and in business. And you basically got scrambled up for a year. You know, mm-hmm. So I went to GE. There was another guy who actually did. There was a guy from GM who went someplace else. There was a guy from Goldman Sachs who went to the FDIC. There was a guy from Reader's Digest who went to the Comptroller of the Currency. I mean, it was really sort of a potpourri of people.
Did they get you together to swap notes or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. No, it was a really cool program. I mean, the first week of the program, you all went to... you had like a week of meetings. Mm-hmm. You know, just these high-level meetings. And then in the middle of the fall, we all went to Wharton for a week and thought great thoughts. And then in January, we went to Europe for 2 weeks. And then in the end of the program, you spent, I don't know, I can't remember whether it was a week or two, a week or 3 or 4 days at the Y Plantation in Maryland, thinking great thoughts and decompressing and talking about this thing. So it was a great program.
Really, so did you manage to keep your seat warm at the SEC? Did you know?
Well, here was the deal. You had to go back, and you had to go back for at least a year. And GE actually offered me a job and told me they wanted me to stay. And I told them I didn't, number one, I needed to fulfill my commitment to the SEC. And when I came back, I said I didn't want to go back to consumer affairs and I wanted to go do something else. And so the SEC sent this guy, Don Lewis, off to Goldman Sachs. And he was an assistant director in Corp Fin, and so I took his chair. And then he came back. I think he came back and also was an assistant director in Corp Fin after he had been gone. And then he retired shortly thereafter. And being an assistant director in Corp Fin was great because it really gave me the meat and potatoes security stuff that I never really had. And that's what I practice today. Mm-hmm.
It must have been a bit of a change coming from Market Reg into Corp Fin.
Yeah, it was. It was really good that I got to come in at a supervisory level, because I probably wouldn't have known what I was doing if somebody handed me a registration statement and said, "Here, go read this and make some comments." So,
what'd you do to get up to speed?
Just read a lot of registration statements.
Okay.
And I had two unbelievably helpful branch chiefs. Who really could have stuck it to me, you know, really could have said, what's this guy doing here? He didn't earn his stripes. Let's make his life miserable. But they were both great. They were both great. So,
Lee Spencer?
No, my branch chiefs were Charlie Leber.
Okay.
And Steve Duvall.
Okay.
And Lee was the deputy director. Was he? Yeah, Ed Green was the director.
Right.
And Ed and I became pretty good friends. And Lee Spencer was the deputy director, and I see Ed around, you know, at conferences and stuff. I haven't seen Lee in years.
Right, and he moved up to director at some point.
Yes, yeah. Ed became general counsel, and Lee became director. Right.
Well, tell me a little bit about what was going on there. There had been a reorganization at Corp Fin. I don't know if that happened before you got there or while you got there. But I know Ed Green was sort of reinventing the place.
It probably happened before I got there. I mean, that sounds familiar. And I think, was Ed Green the one who's sort of responsible for industry centralization? Okay, so when by the time I got there, the place had been reorganized on that score.
Yeah, the question that arose for me was whether your going in there had something to do with that reorganization.
No, but I think Ed was happy to... I mean, Ed kind of liked me. I mean, I didn't grow up in the bureaucracy. I think Ed sort of liked that.
What's that mean, growing up in the bureaucracy?
I mean, the guys who started out either out of law school or financial analysts and started out by reviewing registration statements and just, you know, kind of moved up the totem pole. I mean, I got sort of, I parachuted in. As I said, you know, I really had no business being there other than the executive director and Ed Green stuck me there.
Right.
So
presumably you wouldn't be adhere to the old ways just because they were all...
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly.
Well, you talked about the fact that you were managing, came in at a higher level. Tell me about some of the things that you did, some of the initiatives or things that you were involved in those CorpFin years.
You know, I don't know that I can take credit for any initiatives. I think I can probably take credit for the fact that I managed to keep my head above water and survive. And I think just... by dint of my own sort of interpersonal skills, I was able to make friends with everybody and succeed.
Okay.
And I guess you know, one of the things that our group did a fair amount of was we referred bunches of things to enforcement, and you know, there were a couple of enforcement cases that grew out of disclosure referrals that we made.
Okay. Once again, you have a big thing that's happening, which is this whole integration of the 33 and 34 acts. Again, any impact on the day-to-day for you or your people?
Made sense. I mean, just, you know, sort of made sense. You know,
yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was at a time that people were incorporating by reference these periodic reports, and but I don't have sort of a clear, I don't have kind of a, and so this is what we did, or I mean it was kind of happening, mm-hmm. and it was making sense, and mm-hmm. it was mm-hmm. being more efficient for both the outside and the inside the agency.
But your day to day then would have been making sure that people look at registration statements and keep abreast of disclosure.
My day-to-day was to make sure that registration statements were screened to the extent that they were selected for a full review or a partial review, that review commenced and comments were issued in a timely way, and that we were responsive to the outside world in terms of not impeding the flow of capital in the marketplace mm-hmm. by taking too long to do things or raising BS comments. And, you know, look, to the extent that any of the people in my branch, the branches that I supervise, raise BS comments, I get phone calls from the outside saying, somebody's raising this comment, and would you mind looking into it? And, you know, happily I didn't have that happen much. Mm-hmm. But, you know, from time to time it did. And then it was my job to make sure that when people weren't reviewing registration statements, they were looking at 34 Act reports, which didn't have a capital raising fuse on them. But, I mean, that was always sort of the challenge. If you didn't have a 33 Act registration statement that was burning off your plate, could you really get your discipline together to make sure that you started looking at 10-Ks?
Okay.
Now, Sarbanes-Oxley has changed that, because now the SEC's got to review you every 3 years, but... for that, they didn't have to.
Okay.
Is any of this helpful, or is this?
Yes. Just trying to get a sense of what the commission looked like from your point of view, and the kinds of things that you were doing, and you know, just knowing that some of these initiatives that get all the play were, you know, didn't loom so large for people who were doing the day-to-day work is a helpful insight, I think.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Some of the big initiatives, like the putting the 33 and 34 acts together, or, you know, the push for the national market system. I mean, what you're saying is that when you're doing your day-to-day work, things like that don't necessarily loom terribly large. They're out there, but they're not affecting your day-to-day.
Yeah, I would say that sort of integration affected me more in Corp Fin than the national market system or the central market system affected me in Market Rig.
Okay.
So,
were there policies, practices that were being reshaped, and so were you sort of developing new tools because of integration?
I mean, registration statements were getting shorter. I mean, you'd have these shorter registration statements. I guess part of the review process then was, if you were going to do a full review or something, you make sure that you grabbed everything that was incorporated by reference.
So, right.
I mean, is that...
Yeah, that became the hot term, incorporated by reference.
Sure. And by the way, I mean, I worry about that all the time in my own practice. I mean, in terms of you file a registration statement, you incorporate by reference these documents, and, you know, I say to young associates, let's make sure we look at everything that's incorporated by reference. We need to make sure that it still works. Mm-hmm.
So. Anything else that we should talk about having to do with your time at Corp Fin?
You know, to the extent that one of your companies was involved in a proxy contest or in a tender offer, which was a sort of a hostile tender offer, you got integrally involved in the various disclosures that were coming in about that, and reviewing them and making sure that you were reviewing them in a timely way so that people could get their deals done. So. And those were the really fun transactions. I mean, that was a lot of fun when somebody was making a hostile tender offer for one of your companies, mm-hmm. And the company was fighting it and putting out disclosures telling the shareholders not to tender, and the guys doing the tender offer were saying, you know, they're a bunch of crumb bums. You really ought to tender to us. And so that was fun. And then proxy contests the same, to the extent that. Insurgents were trying to replace the board and saying that the board has done a terrible job and the shareholder returns have been terrible and they can't manage the way out of a paper bag. I mean, that was all exciting disclosure stuff.
And you were sitting right in the middle of it.
Yeah, I mean, I was really, as an assistant director, you're really sort of the arbiter of it.
Okay.
You know, material, whether you were going to clear the material or not.
And that would have been a pretty hot time for that, the early 80s,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you see it pick up?
Yeah. And then they did that tender offer study that Linda Quinn did, mm-hmm. that was responsible for a couple of the tender offer rules. And she was a very good friend. You know, she died.
Right.
She died, I'll tell you, she must have died 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So she was great. Very good friend.
All right. Well, what made you think about moving on from the commission?
Private school tuition bills.
Yeah, old story, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
I talked to my father, and he was totally non-responsive. So, reminded me that I told him, I said that I got this private school tuition bill, and it was for 3 hours for kindergarten. And I told him how much it was, and I thought the response should be, "Don't worry, I'll pick that up." And his response was, "Tuition, room, and board where you went to boarding school was less." So.
All right. Did you, you went back into private practice at that point. Did you stay in D.C. or did you go?
I moved here in 1983.
Okay.
I left the SEC in 1983 and I moved to a firm it's now called Dilworth Paxson.
Okay.
It's a great firm. It's going to sort of implode in the early 90s and I left and came here in 92. I've been here ever since.
Okay. How is your SEC, other than the obvious, and you mentioned the fact that you learned a lot of what you use today in Corp Fin, other than the obvious, tell me a little bit about how your SEC experience has shaped the rest of your career.
Well, it's a credential that you have, and you will always have it. I mean, there are times that I compete for business with other lawyers around town, and prospective clients will say, so tell me, why should I hire you instead of XYZ at the Pepper Hamilton firm or at the Morgan Lewis firm? Mm-hmm. And the honest answer to this is, look, you should hire who you want to hire. You should hire the person with whom you have the best chemistry, because frankly, you're going to get the same kind of good legal advice from me or from, and I can give you three or four, you know, I can give you three or four names that are the people I always compete with. And the fact of the matter is without casting any aspersions, I can say I was at the SEC and they weren't. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it's a huge marketing advantage, but I think it has some cachet associated with it. The mm-hmm. fact. Now I've been gone for 27 years, which means that there are a lot of people who were not there when I was there. On the other hand, there were plenty of people who were there who still are there.
Right.
And it gives you some ability to it gives you some ability to pick up the phone and call somebody and
right
get some direction as to who you ought to be talking to. And I think that that's enormously helpful.
Yeah.
And
is there some intangible that you've had from actually having been inside the SEC?
Yeah, I think that there probably is. I mean, look, I'm sure things have changed enormously since I was there. On the other hand, I mean, there are so many people who sort of hypothesize the way things are done. Like, I know that the SEC is going to look at this, and you can say, well, if they don't review it, they're not going to look at it at all. And that sort of seems amazing. You know, I spent all this time putting together this filing, and I filed it and everything, and nobody's going to look at it. So, yeah, I think you get sort of a sense as you have a little bit better sense as to how they think about things.
Great. Anything else that we should talk about having to do with your career at the Securities
Exchange? I loved it. I mean, it was terrific. It was a, wouldn't trade it in for anything. It's not as if I look around and say, gee, if I'd only been in private practice for those 9 years that I was there, I would be considerably wealthier. I mean, it just, doesn't at all resonate that way. So right. I'm really pleased that I was there.
All right. Well, thank you very much.